Just days ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a very scary threat to the world, putting Russia's nuclear forces on alert, raising fears that Russia's war on Ukraine, now in its ninth day, could lead to further escalation. And meanwhile, Russian forces have captured a huge nuclear power station in the southeastern part of the country. Talking about Russia's intentions here on The Morning Show, I'm Kedar Cherkent. The Federation of American Scientists estimates Russia has nearly 6,000 nuclear warheads, more than any other country. Are you worried that Putin could use these weapons? What should the U.S. or NATO do in response? 800-642-1234. John Arath is Senior Policy Director for the nonpartisan and nonprofit Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So as we digest this news that Russian military forces have taken control of a huge nuclear power station, what do you make of this development?
It's a very serious thing anytime you have explosions going off in the area of a nuclear power station. It's not clear from the reports that are available so far exactly what is happening there and what the level of danger is. But the important thing to keep in mind is that a nuclear power station is very big. Everybody knows where it is. It's impossible to miss. So if there's fighting going on in the neighborhood, it is done intentionally. With the intent of in some way attacking, capturing, or causing damage to that nuclear power plant. That can be potentially very dangerous.
Why would the Russian military specifically want control of these nuclear power plants?
I'm going to go with the simple reason first, because simple is usually the best. It's because the people who plan Russian military operations still have something of the old Soviet mindset. They focus on the important targets being heavy industry, power generation, things like that. They're trying to establish dominance over that area of Ukraine, and holding the keys to the electrical power grid is a way to do that.
The U.S. established a communications hotline with Russian forces to prevent an accidental clash. And I'm just wondering, what does that mean? How significant is it to have a military-to-military channel?
In areas where militaries are operating in proximity, it can be very important. There was something done very similar a few years back in Syria. Where we had U.S. and Russian forces in the same space. With U.S. forces in NATO countries bordering on Ukraine, and U.S. aircraft operating in the skies over those countries, it's important to be able to deconflict with Russian aircraft in particular, but also other Russian forces that may start operating in those areas so that we can avoid accidental incidents.
So when the U.S. and Russian military did establish that back channel after Russia entered the war in Syria, did it prove useful then? I mean, will it prove useful now?
If it avoids people shooting at each other, it is necessarily useful. We will see just how much it comes into play in this case, because the U.S. forces border on Western Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So far, there have been few, if any, Russian military operations in that part of the country.
Talking with John Arath, Senior Policy Director for the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, you can join in. Are you worried that Russia could be pushed to use nuclear weapons? What should the U.S. or NATO do in these moments? Join in at 800-642-1234. John, what does Russia's recent change in rhetoric on nuclear weapons, what does that mean for Western allies? What does it mean for the U.S.?
It's a clear message to the West. Russia does not need nuclear weapons to do what it is doing in Ukraine. They're doing this with conventional forces. However, it's important to remember what the many times Vladimir Putin said that Ukraine is not a real country. That's how many in the Russian elite think about their neighbors, that it's an artificial construct, and that all the Russian military had to do was knock on the door and the whole house would fall over. That has not been the case. The Ukrainian resistance has proved to be much stronger than the Russians had expected. Their forces are bogged down and are experiencing significant losses that they also did not expect. Given that they're going up against people that they don't consider to be a real military with a real country, what is happening there in Moscow is that they are thinking that part of the reason for the Ukrainian resistance is they are getting foreign assistance. Putin wants to warn off the rest of the world, say, do not help Ukraine. And so he's doing this by coming up with the threat he feels has the most resonance that will scare more people. And that is, we have these nuclear weapons. We might even think about using them. A couple of weeks ago, I would have said that was unthinkable. Back in January, Russia and the other nuclear weapon states issued a joint statement which echoed the 1985 Reagan-Gorbachev statement that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. It went on to say nuclear weapons are only for defensive purposes. So a little more than a month later, that has been totally turned around. And instead of having nuclear weapons to defend one's own country against a potential attack, Putin is saying, I'm using these weapons to cover up my aggression and make sure nobody interferes with that aggression against my neighbor. That is a very concerning development.
The exact number of nuclear weapons in each country's possession is certainly a closely held national secret. How accurate do you think are the estimates of the nuclear capabilities of Russia and the world?
The estimates are fairly accurate. There's been a great deal of research that gets done in various academic organizations and think tanks on this. The precise numbers, of course, are closely held secrets, but generally we know about how many nuclear weapons are where. Part of the reason we know this is there is a treaty, the New START treaty, that limits the number of strategic weapons that the U.S. and Russia have. And there is a information exchange and verification measures in place that allow us to have a fairly high degree of confidence in those numbers.
Let's bring on a caller. Tony is with us from Egg Harbor. Tony, hi, what's on your mind?
A lot of things. How deep is the Russian dictator's bench in carrying out this takeover of Europe, ultimately? And if he should reach his timely demise, is there enough people on his bench that want to really keep this thing going?
Tony, thank you. What do you make of that, John? Would there someone step up in Putin's shoes to carry out this war?
It would depend on the circumstances of his demise. If there is a change in government in Russia, presumably it will be done out of frustration with the course of the war and the losses Russia has sustained. In that case, whoever takes over will be very careful not to repeat the mistakes that Putin made that led to his being ousted. So if there's a change, it would quite likely also be accompanied by a change in the overall policy.
You know, I mean, we saw a meeting yesterday with the president of France, Macron, who has had, you know, multiple talks with Putin, but the U.S. has not talked directly with Putin about this. Should Biden and Putin talk?
You're asking that of someone who spent 30 years as a U.S. diplomat. Mm-hmm. So I believe that there's always a good reason to talk, at least before we fight. So if I were advising President Biden, I would be saying if there is an opportunity to talk to Putin, take it. But at this point, I don't know that it would do much good. Putin has decided that he is going to establish some level of dominance over Ukraine by military force. And if he were to back away in the short term, it would be a significant loss of face for him. And that's something that, generally speaking, dictators cannot stand.
John Arath, expert on diplomacy and arms control agreements, former 30-year veteran of the State Department, now with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. What do you make of Putin's nuclear saber rattling? What is the likelihood he would use these weapons What questions do you have about the U.S. missile defense system? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John Arith here on the Ideas Network. The wording President Putin used Sunday when he put Russian deterrence forces on a, quote, special mode of combat duty. We're discussing Putin's nuclear capabilities on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. and Russia own the vast majority of the world's nuclear weapons. According to the Federation of American Scientists, the world's combined inventory of nuclear warheads remains at a very high level. Nine countries possessed roughly 12,700 warheads as of last month. What concerns you? What foreign policy would be steps toward peace? Join in 800-642-1234. John Arith, Senior Policy Director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, with us for about nine more minutes. Let's bring in Jack in Williams Bay. Jack, hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask John about any similarities with what happened in Chechnya, how Putin behaved there, kind of terrifying, you know, what happened there and what happened to their capital. From what I read, it was like virtually reduced to rubble during that war, and a lot of suffering. And I was, that's my fear about Ukraine, is that this could go on with devastation. I just wanted to ask John what he thought about that.
Jack, thank you. John, go ahead.
Clearly, that's a very big worry. The Russian military is doing something that is somewhat common in to armies everywhere, and that is that they tend to refight the last war. And what they understand, what their narrative is that the campaign in Chechnya ultimately worked, succeeded for them. And so they have that script, and they show every sign that they could be rerunning it in Ukraine. There are key differences, though, and that is that Ukraine is a much, much larger country and has much greater capability to fight back. And this is what we are seeing so far. Unfortunately, this is a recipe for a humanitarian disaster. And we're already seeing, I think estimates are over a million refugees and displaced persons. And that's something that is very serious and is a consequence of the policies that the Russian government has adopted.
You know, we saw a second round of negotiations, of talks, turning out perhaps a humanitarian corridor, perhaps a moment of ceasefire to be able to get people out of the crossfire. Do you see any movement in those talks? Are they productive at all?
If the humanitarian corridors turn out to be real and are put into operation, that would certainly avoid some of the civilian casualties that have so far been accompanying this war. But time will tell if they actually are implemented the way that it was negotiated. Apart from that, there's been very little progress, it appears, and I'm not privy to exactly what's going on, but it appears that most of the Russian demands are somewhere along the lines of go ahead and surrender and then we'll talk. Mm. And if you've ever negotiated with Russians, you know this is part of their standard playbook. It's like going in and going to a used car lot and being told that the car you want is $100,000, no bargaining, and negotiating from there.
John Arith, Senior Policy Director for the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Let's take another call now. Joe is joining us from Toma. Joe, hi.
Hi, good morning. So question for John is more in regards to the potential underlying intent of the actual engagement. So recently there's been a lot of natural gas discovery in the Crimea region, as well as in Western Ukraine. How much of that do you think is a factor in Putin's strategy and also kind of the national strategic occupation of the Black Sea into his calculus? Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate those questions, Joe. John, go ahead.
The Russian government has not substantially changed its strategy on Ukraine for 30 years, even pre-Putin. The assumption has always been that Ukraine naturally should be a client state of Russia and should dance to whatever tune is being called in Moscow. So that element of the strategy has remained the same. It's how they go about subjugating Ukraine that is now vastly different. Russia is the Russian economy depends largely on the exports of fossil fuels, including oil and gas. So they are going to be interested in having more that they can exploit and using the Black Sea a route to export some of these resources. But the overall motivation is primarily political. They believe that Ukraine, in the natural order of things, should be a client state for Russia. And that is really what is motivating the Russian actions.
Joel now in Siren. Joel, go ahead.
My question is, what is Russia going to need to do for America? Well, what is Russia going to need to do for America to respond with military actions?
Joel, thank you. What would happen for America to step up militarily against Russia?
First of all, Ukraine is obviously not a member of NATO. So there is no treaty commitment saying that we are required legally to go to participate in a war in Ukraine. That said, there are many, many reasons why it would be bad for a war between Russia and America to begin right now. But what they come down to is nuclear weapons. The fact that the US and Russia have the first and second largest numbers of nuclear weapons in the world means that a military confrontation between the two has the potential to become very, very dangerous and very deadly. And so leaders on both sides are going to want to do what they can to avoid that. In terms of specific actions that could bring the US into the fight, I think it would be the death of US servicemen and attacks on NATO countries bordering on Ukraine. That's the most likely trigger for some kind of conflict.
What comes to mind in that tension is the push by Ukraine to create a no-fly zone over the country and the U.S. not engaging with a no-fly zone. Is that the kind of escalation as well that you would worry about?
Again, it would put U.S. and Russian forces in
head-to-head
in close proximity in a violent situation. And that's when mistakes can be made, and that's when that could provoke the conflict between the two biggest nuclear powers. So we want to be very careful to avoid this, but at the same time, provide such support as we can to Ukraine.
I know you're a diplomat at heart, but where is the path forward here? How do you, at this point, negotiate with Russia? How do you stop the shelling?
That's a very difficult question right now. As I said earlier, Russia has determined to continue on this violent path that they are on. They're trying to resolve this issue by use of overwhelming force. It's not working very well. We need to keep the avenues for diplomacy, for dialogue open as much as possible when the Russians are ready to do so. But at the same time, do two things. First is to keep demonstrating to Putin that this has made him an outlaw, that this is not acceptable, that he is doing damage to his country's reputation and to his country's economy. So the sanctions are relatively mild so far. They can still get tougher. Keep doing that. The other thing is assist the Ukrainian people so that they understand that their resistance is bearing fruit, that they are stopping the Russian military, and that they are inflicting the kind of casualties on Russia that are going to eventually get the Russian people to take notice and rethink this course that they have embarked upon.
John, thank you for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure.
John Arath, Senior Policy Director for the Nonpartisan and Nonprofit Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Just ahead, we turn to a Russia expert who has written, edited more than 20 books on Russian politics and Ukraine. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Stay with us. More conversation. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Russia's war on Ukraine now entering its ninth day. Russian forces have escalated their attacks on crowded cities while Ukraine's forces defy the odds and try to remain in control of their cities under fire. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Pentagon, as we talked about, has established a channel of direct communication with the Russian Defense Ministry to avoid unintended conflict. Are you worried about nuclear escalation? What about the humanitarian crisis at hand? What should the U.S. and NATO do next? Join in 800-642-1234. Taras Kuzio is an associate research fellow at the Henry Jackson Society. That's a London-based research group. Professor in the Department of Political Science at the National University of Kyiv Mohyluk Academy in Ukraine. Taras, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning or good afternoon here.
Thank you. Yes, as we see the UN Security Council going into an emergency meeting and learning Russian military forces have taken control of a huge nuclear plant in Ukraine, what does this development mean to you?
Well, it's very dangerous. The nuclear power plant in question is the biggest in Europe. So potentially, if anything was to go wrong, a radiation could spread throughout Europe. We have to remember that in 1986, the nuclear accident at the Chernobyl nuclear plant to the north of Kyiv, that when that went off, it spread radiation throughout Scandinavia and northern England. And there's still that radiation is still there. I mean, it takes centuries for it to go away. So, of course, this is dangerous and Russia should be condemned for potentially putting this into danger.
You say President Putin believes that he's at war with the West. Why is he focused on Ukraine specifically?
Well, because he sees that he believes that Ukraine is a Russian land, and therefore Ukraine should be within the Russian sphere of influence. And he thinks that America in particular, but the West in general, has stolen, as it were, this Russian land from him. So he sees, and Russian TV and media have been saying for the last 8 years that Ukraine is a U.S. puppet state, and that the real people in charge are in Washington, not in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. And so that's one aspect. The second aspect is that he's a former KGB officer. He's very much nostalgic for the Soviet Union, and he hates NATO. He hates the United States. People like him with that kind of dictatorial regime need enemies. They have domestic enemies, which are his opponents on the political front, and he needs external enemies. I mean, those kind of regimes cannot exist without enemies. The enemies are so-called U.S. puppets like Ukraine, the U.S., NATO, the West in general, democracy, and those are all his enemies.
Let's bring on a caller, Ed in McFarland. Ed, hi, go ahead.
Hello. My question is, was this action by Putin an inevitability? Does it matter the U.S.'s foreign policy, and with the changing administration, changes in foreign policy have any impact on the timing of this?
Thank you, Ed. Go ahead, Taras.
I don't think so. I think there are many factors involved. I mean, Putin's been... The nationalism that's been growing in the Kremlin has been growing for at least sort of 15, 17 years since the Ukrainian Orange Revolution of 2004. So I don't think that Putin has become extremely isolated and out of touch, even with the people around him during the COVID pandemic in the last 2 years. You see that when he meets anybody, he's paranoid. He sits on an extremely long table and people sit at the other end. So that's a factor as well. There's nobody around him who was telling him, hey, we shouldn't be doing this. This is really crazy. So he surrounded himself by sycophants, stroking his ego. American administrations vis-a-vis Ukraine and Russia, all of them have good and bad points. Barack Obama is a dirty word in Ukraine and Georgia. Why? Because in 2014, he did nothing to help Ukraine, and he vetoed the sending of military equipment to Ukraine. Donald Trump's administration supported, or he didn't block at the very least, the sending of military equipment to Ukraine, even though Donald Trump on many occasions tried to become very pally with Vladimir Putin.
Calling him a genius recently.
Yeah, calling him a genius recently. And so, you know, I mean, I'm not sure Donald Trump would look as good without his shirt off as Putin. I don't think Donald Trump goes to the gym as much. But he certainly had this admiration for a strong macho guy. So that was a bit odd, a bit strange. At the same time, you know, the people around Trump were kind of typical Republicans, quite tough on Russia. So they were quite good. And also the Trump team imposed sanctions on the German gas pipeline going to Russia, which is Nord Stream 2. Then we have Biden coming in. Biden's an Obama guy. So at first, people like me were very worried that he would just be continuing Obama's kind of lack of direction in international relations. It wasn't just Ukraine. Obama was terrible in foreign policy in general. Remember his non-existent red lines in Syria. But I think we've been proven wrong. I think the Biden team have done very well during this crisis. And this is the first time ever that the US or any Western NATO member has used this tactic of publicizing intelligence from the other side to stop the other side doing actions. And this is the Biden team have been doing that very successfully, I think, throughout the last 4 months. And you can't fault the Biden administration for its tough sanctions, and also for the sending of military equipment. I mean, everybody thinks that maybe something more could be done, but certainly they have done better than I expected, shall we say.
Taras Kuzio, Associate Research Fellow at the Henry Jackson Society think tank in London. You can join in with your questions about the Russian invasion, where we go from here. Could the U.S. or NATO allies have prevented this? And what should be next steps? 800-642-1234. Steve is with us from Oshkosh, wanting to talk about the sanctions and their conditions. Steve, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I've read a few books about that that have been arguing for sanctions for years and years. Blood Oil by Leif Winar, Winter is Coming by Garry Kasparov. They're arguing that we need sanctions. We need to have moral principles governing our international trade. And so I'm really excited to see that we're finally implementing trade sanctions. But I don't know. I wonder what the conditions are. Are there conditions that they have to be met beyond just the ending of the war? What about conditions regarding democracy in Russia or popular sovereignty over their natural resources?
Great question, Steve. Thank you. Taras?
Well, the sanctions that have been imposed now are at the level of what they should have been in 2014, when I think sanctions imposed by the Obama administration and by the West were very, very weak. If you want to put it on a scale of 10, in 2014, it was about 3 out of 10, which is pitiful, to be honest, in response to the annexation of Crimea and the shooting down of MH17, which killed 300 innocent people, including 88 children. And today, where it's about 8 out of 10. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the same kind of level of sanctions as what the U.S. imposed against Iran. So I think we've gone the right way. I mean, where the caller is right, and what maybe he's kind of hinting at, is the fact that Putin's biggest export is not oil and gas, it's corruption. He uses corruption strategically to corrupt Western elites. And by doing that, he then leads to public resentment at those elites, and those and then the sort of the voting public then starts to support anti-establishment populists. And you see this throughout Europe, to some degree in the US, with Donald Trump's rise. And that's a deliberate tactic of it was a tactic of the Soviet Union, it's a tactic of Russia today, of a way to sort of bring down or demoralize and Western democracies, and to decrease public trust in democratic institutions.
Well, will the sanctions affect life on the streets of Russia? I mean, will Russians turn on him because they are feeling the effects of these sanctions?
Yes, we don't know whether to what degree they will turn on him, but they certainly will impact the average Russian. And we are talking about a collapse in the Russian economy in the next month or so, next 2 months, of upwards of 40%. So something of the region of the 1998 crisis in Russia. I'm reading just today that there are upwards of 40 million Russians who want to emigrate. This is out of a population of about 140 million. Mm. This is leading to a panic situation. Putin and his cronies are living in an isolated bubble. They're divorced from their own population. To a great degree, they don't give a damn about their own citizens. But yes, it will have a tremendous impact. I mean, the goal of these sanctions, the ultimate goal, is to heavily, really aggressively impact on the Russian economy, and thereby turn, as you say, try and turn the population. I mean, there have been mass protests already, mm-hmm. which is difficult in a country which is a dictatorship. This is not even a corrupt democracy, it's a dictatorship. So those people, I think it's something in the region of 10,000 people have been arrested. Mm. There's also a petition going around with 1 million signatures by Russians who are opposed to the war. This is not a popular war in Russia. In 2014, most Russians supported the annexation of Crimea because Crimea has a very close symbolic relationship to Russian nationalism. And that's not true of this war. So I think that Putin here is on dodgy ground. He's miscalculated both domestic reaction in Russia, the Western reaction. He expected it to be weak and divided, and that's not been the case. And he miscalculated Ukraine, of course. He thought it would be a cakewalk. He thought he'd occupy the country in 2 days. Well, sorry, he
won't.
Not
the case. Ukrainian political, economic, and security affairs expert Taras Kuzio stays with us. Do you have friends or family living in that region? Do you worry about their safety? Should the U.S. be deploying troops to Europe or supplying additional weapons to Ukraine to support NATO forces helping Ukraine? Still time to talk these things through. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Taras Kuzio here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Russia's war on Ukraine on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Following the second round of talks yesterday, Russian and Ukrainian defense ministries, they agreed on providing humanitarian corridors for civilians trapped in the fighting. Our expert earlier, John Arath, said we have to see if those corridors actually hold and details matter. So how do you want the West to stand up to Putin and deter Russia? What concerns you about the comments from the French president that Putin appears determined to invade the entire country? Still time, 800-642-1234. Taras Kuzio, an analyst at the Henry Jackson Society, with us for 9 more minutes. Taras, something you just said there, that Putin perceives Western democracies are in a weakened state, in a vulnerable state. So that makes this moment now the time to launch a military incursion. Can you explore that a little further?
Well, There are two sides to this. On the one hand, it's true that I think Western democracies are more divided than they have been in the past, with the rise of, shall we say, populist parties and movements, and in Europe in particular, the rise of the far right against immigration and such like. But on the other hand, I don't think that people in the Kremlin understand the outside world. I mean, remember, they're looking at the outside world through their very Soviet and communist background and kind of mentality.
The products of the Cold War, perhaps?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So they don't really get us. They don't really understand us. I mean, democracies are not perfect. They're the best we've got, but they're not perfect. And they are sometimes, you know, messy in terms of debates and arguments and divisions, but ultimately they're still quite strong systems. I don't think they quite understand how these things work. So one of the aspects of this crisis is that they were absolutely convinced that there would be a very divided West, a very weak Western response. Maybe they expected it to be as weak sanctions as in 2014. And they expected them to be bickering amongst, you know, West Europeans. There's always going to be the pro-Russian countries like France and Germany, and the more critically disposed towards Russia like Britain, Poland, the Baltic states. But what was shown to be the case is that the West has been very united. And I think you have to commend the Biden administration for working very closely with Europe on this and creating that united Western front, because Donald Trump didn't do that. Donald Trump was very much in favor of basically arguing all the time with Europe and not really wanting to show a united front. So I think the West has done very well here, and I think Russia has been very surprised, but it doesn't understand Ukraine, doesn't understand the West.
Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander with a question. Rich, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I'm asking for your guest's view on whether or not he thinks Russian oligarchs could greatly reduce the impact of sanctions by manipulating their wealth through cryptocurrencies.
We've seen that in the news. Rich, thank you. Taras, what about, reverting to other types of currency like Bitcoin?
I'm not an expert on Bitcoin, so it's difficult to answer on that. I think that the Russian oligarchs are finished in terms of their... I mean, Putin used these Russian oligarchs in the West as the spreaders of the Kremlin's influence. That's what their purpose was. And when they bought football clubs like in Britain, sorry, that's soccer clubs to Americans.
That's okay, we follow.
Okay. I'm speaking the Queen's English. I know it's sometimes different to American. But they were spreading the Moscow's influence. There's an article in today's Economist, for example, that says it's the end of Londongrad. What do they mean? Because London got the nickname Londongrad or Moscow on the Thames because of all the dirty money coming in from these Russians. So all of that's now finished. I mean, Western governments, I think, including the US, are talking about nationalizing oligarch assets, their palaces and their yachts. That's already begun in Germany, by the way. And there's even talk in Britain that these palaces will be used to house Ukrainian refugees. So the days of these oligarchs enjoying a great lifestyle in the US, and by the way, it's not just Europe, it's the US. There's a lot of dirty money has bought property in the US as well. They love Florida, for example.
Let's fit in Phil in Mount Horeb with a question. Phil, go ahead.
Hi. My question revolves around the longer term here. I see Russia beating Ukraine to an absolute pulp if things continue along the current course. My thinking would be that by modeling on the Afghan strategy, which is a prolonged insurgency supplied with anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles, SAMs and others, the Ukrainians could prolong the war and just exhaust and throw the Russians in this entanglement back to Russia, just as the Afghans did. I'd like to know what your guest thinks about the strategy of saving Ukraine and avoiding the potential for a international conflagration, and using the Ukrainians, who have already demonstrated their firm resolve and resistance here, get Zelensky out, make him a leader from afar, and then subdue the Russians.
And let's turn it to Taras as we're short on time. Taras, go ahead.
Yeah, I understand your point. I mean, the Afghans defeated everybody who's invaded them, including the British in the late 19th century. They seem to have been quite good at that. There's no question that there'll be a massive resistance movement. I mean, Ukraine's got the third largest army in Europe. I mean, those soldiers won't go away, even if, you know, some parts are defeated. I think the war will continue indefinitely. I mean, I look at videos and of captured prisoners. I mean, the amount of Russian military equipment destroyed, the amount of prisoners. Russia has practically, in just over a week's war, it's now the eighth day of the war, Russia has 9,000, something over 9,000 dead. Hmm. To put that into context, that's more than what the Americans suffered in Iraq over 8 years. It's practically at the level of what America suffered in Afghanistan over 20 years. Hmm. So Russia's already lost that many number. Now, the difference is, in a democracy, you know, we governments are accountable for those deaths, and you know, governments have to be responsible.
Well,
in Russia, that's not the case. Putin doesn't give a damn about that. So resistance will be there. There's no question. Ukrainians will put up that fight. They are getting a lot of decent equipment already from Americans, even from the Germans for the first time.
And Taras, we will be watching. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Taras Kuzio, Associate Research Fellow at the Henry Jackson Society Research Group in London. Now I want to correct something I said Wednesday during a show about low-wage workers. I said a previous guest on the program had felt no remorse for paying minimum wage to teenagers. That was incorrect. And I really appreciate the guest reaching out and saying they believe the legal minimum wage is not a livable one, and they support paying more than a minimum wage to adults working full-time jobs. And they said the food service industry helps teens develop important life and career skills, but, and I'm quoting here, it is simply not a level playing field to compare the wages earned by those still in high school and wages that should be and frequently are paid to adults. I regret the error, and I really appreciate that it was brought to my attention so we can have these frank, honest discussions here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thank you so much for listening to the Ideas Network.